You'd start off circling Marble Arch late at night, or Hyde Park as well, in the 1940s. In the 50s, some of the bars start to open. They're not open in sense of, you know, advertising as gay bars or anything like that. Of course not.
In 1967, for the first time in more than 400 years, two men over 21 were legally allowed to have sex in private with each other. It was a leap forward. It was also fiercely opposed by many lawmakers and by most of the public. Even by the late 80s, three quarters of Britons still thought gay sex was always or mostly wrong. A gay man who tried to stand as an MP would be vilified. What was it like to be a gay man after the war? Did life get any easier after the law changed? What did it mean to live in a society where the majority found homosexuality dangerous and repellent, and much of the law backed them up? I'm Ros Taylor, and this is Jam Tomorrow. Are you a gay bachelor interested in male-only activities? I am forming a social club in London. Send stamped addressed envelope for details. Cozy lodgings with meals available. That was a small ad placed in a magazine in the late 1960s, when MPs were debating whether and how to legalise gay sex. It's not exactly Grindr, but it was quoted in the Commons with disgust by the MP for Totnes, Ray Morby. He wanted to make it illegal to promote acts of homosexuality, and by that, he meant ads like these. These days, 1967 is seen as a benchmark in gay history. But even after the change in the law, gay men still faced huge risks and difficulties when they wanted to meet other men and spend time with them. George Lucas was a man who experienced what life was like both before and after the new law. By day, he was a civil servant at the Board of Trade. By night, he cruised the West End of London looking for gay sex. Journalist Hugo Greenhalgh has edited his diaries for a book that's coming out in May. Hugo, who was Mr. Lucas?
How do I start this? I mean, he was a fascinating character. You know, born in 1926, died in 2014, so lived to a grand old age of 88. I first came across him when I was working as a researcher on documentary about male prostitution. And my job as researcher was obviously to put adverts in all the gay papers. Have you ever paid for sex? Have you been paid for sex? And Mr. Lucas came forward and said, yes, I've been paying for sex for 30, 40 years. We thought, great. So I was sent round to do the pre-interview, and during the course of, I was there for about an hour and a half, you know, chatting about the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And in the background, I see these bank of books, ranging in size, some slim, some large, some voluminous, some overflowing with photographs, clippings, all manner of collected crap. And I say, what are those? And he says, well, these are my diaries. And down they came. And it was an absolute goldmine of lost queer history. But as a person, he was an unremarkable person, but with a remarkable story. I mean, he was a civil servant. I mean, very classic crisp-like job, you know, by day working at the Board of Trade. But by night, he was out on the queer scene, the gay scene of London in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and came home every night without fail and wrote about it in his diaries.
And where did you go if you were gay in the late 40s and early 50s in London to pick up men?
Well, you'd start off at Marble Arch, circling Marble Arch late at night, or Hyde Park as well, in the 1940s. In the 50s, some of the bars start to open. They're not open in sense of, you know, advertising as gay bars or anything like that, of course not. But there were places like the Golden Lion, which comes into its own in the 60s. Actually, there's a story from the 1980s to jump forward a bit. Dennis Nilsson, the serial killer, it was his favourite pub. So you had a lot of these kind of places whereby criminality, okay, serial killer, but also criminality of the underworld of London society rubbed shoulders with the queer world as well. I mean, obviously at that point, before 1967, when gay sex was partially decriminalised in England and Wales, everybody who was having gay sex was a criminal. So the intertwining of those two worlds was just incredible, basically. 40s and 50s, we're talking about kind of pubs, kind of, I should say, shrubs, bushes and parks and gardens and Marble Arch. But as the 50s become the 60s, you do see a lot more of the bar scene opening. Again, the Golden Lion, the White Bear, you know, lots of these kind of little places where, you know, the music club, the carousel, these kind of private clubs. So we're kind of, you know, above the third floor somewhere in Soho that you had a membership card to get into. But it was very much a secret world of nods and winks at that stage.
And Mr. Lucas knew the risks of this because he had already been arrested earlier in his life in Germany, hadn't he?
It's a horrible story. Back in 1950, he was serving as an officer in the British Army, stationed abroad in Germany at the time. And he says very poignantly in one of his diary entries, at 6:30, I was a serving officer of the King's Guard. At 7:30, I was under arrest for having importuned a German civilian. He was sentenced to 6 months military jail. He got out after about 3 months. It was the most bizarre jail ever. It's the cushiest jail. He writes about kind of going to the cinema every evening, writes about Albert and Costello movies, and, you know, drinking sherry after dinner. But he was kicked out of the army and came home in 1951, very much in disgrace at that point.
So he had, was an ex-soldier, and he had a bit of a penchant for soldiers, didn't he?
I think you can say he had a penchant for a bit of rough, basically. I mean, one thing when I got the diaries, I mean, he died in, as I said, 2014. And actually, the process of his death was appalling because I was one of the executors of his will, so kind of rushed around. But at that stage, you know, a lot of his possessions were in skips. I mean, I literally fished out quite a few of the diaries from a skip. But, I mean, when I got them, I thought, okay, great, fantastic, what a goldmine, brilliant. But I will check just to make sure that his tastes do run older. See, if we are talking about men here, men that he paid for sex. But yeah, labourers, layabouts, the unemployed, guardsmen. Guardsmen. Those were his absolute Coldstreams, you name it. He would absolutely, that would be the acme of his success, basically, to have paid or slept with a guardsman that night.
We're talking about hundreds, maybe even more, encounters over the course of decades?
Oh, easily, yes, quite frankly. I mean, I think he once tallied that he'd had paid or sex with about 35 men 1 year. So if you look at kind of 60 years of sexual activity, do the maths.
Was he entirely comfortable with his sexuality? Because it must have been very difficult to be comfortable with your sexuality at that time in Britain.
He was a devout Catholic as well. So, and a guilt ran through a lot of everything he did. He went for a very religious period in the 1950s where he swore off sex to a certain extent. So going down from 35 to maybe 10 a year. But he wrestled with not necessarily his sexuality. He calls himself gay very early on. Not homosexual, but gay in the 50s, which is quite remarkable, not in a kind of happy sense, but actually, I am gay. And he's always been very clear that his sexuality is God-given, it's something he's comfortable with. I mean, he had his first sexual encounter in his teens, I think, with a house painter. And it's interesting looking at that. Again, he writes about those encounters later in the diary, so you're looking backwards. But there's no sense of guilt or shame. He's comfortable with his sexuality and he's comfortable with who he is, despite this huge amount of Catholic guilt and parents who were incredibly, intensely, viciously homophobic. But he himself was never a happy homosexual. He was never a happy character, but he was comfortable with his sexuality.
And he never settled down, had a long-term, really long-term partner. Why was that, do you think?
He was an awkward character writ large, basically. Very selfish, very stubborn, very opinionated, which is a fantastic skill and fantastic kind of attribute, rather, for a diarist, because he writes with such incredible kind of elegance and aplomb and anger and bitterness at times, which, I mean, you don't want a diarist who's happy. You don't want a diarist who wanders through life and everything's great, everything's wonderful. So the bitterness and the, at times, disillusionment with his life makes him a far better diarist and makes him far better for us to read him. In terms of partners, they flit in and out for months, weeks, whatever. There's a grand passion in the 1960s with somebody, Irish Johnny, who, when we first meet him, is a kind of, you know, 19-20-year-old rent boy in Piccadilly Circus. And by the end of the 60s, is a member of the Cray Twins gang. So it's a fascinating kind of story of passion, betrayal, and just the danger of coming so close to criminality.
And was he aware that, was Mr. Lucas aware that he was a criminal? And
yes. In a word. And I think that was part of the thrill, basically. You know, Irish Johnny starts off as a fencer, you know, selling stolen goods, but then graduates to more violent crime and actually ends up robbing Mr. Lucas viciously a couple of times in the late 60s. So what starts as a financial transaction, then becomes a friendship, then becomes a sort of a love affair, ends incredibly badly.
So you brought some of the diaries into the studio and they're next to me on the table. And it's extraordinary. This is closely written, what looks like thousands and thousands of pages interspersed with pictures of often, usually men, actually. And I opened one and found one of them.
I'm sorry about the willy, by the way.
That's okay. It was a man with a rather large member sitting in a living room. So that was... But you must have been amazed when you came across these. And did you read them all at once? Did you binge read them?
No, I'm still reading them now. I mean, we're talking about kind of about 14 War and Pieces, basically. I mean, zillions, millions, millions upon millions of words. I mean, I've read pretty much up to 1975, but you start in the 1940s and 50s in quite slim volumes. And then in the 60s, they grow larger. And you've got, I think, 79 and 80-something over there. And as you can see, the 1950, I was just explain this for listeners, it's very slim. 70s and the 80s are just out of control. I mean, they're just huge, overflowing with, again, photographs, clippings. I mean, again, all manner of collected crap, basically.
So how did the gay scene change as time went on? Did it change in terms of location? Did it change in the way he was picking men up?
I think for Mr. Lucas in particular, it changed. It went from being a community of sorts to something far more commercial, which is ironic for Mr. Lucas's transactional nature with sex. But I think because of that, because it became far more commercial in the 70s and 80s, it left him behind. The gay scene, the queer scene, where everyone in the world is very cruel to those of us, I'm now 50, who are getting on in years. So I think he becomes far more alienated by the gay scene, the queer scene, as he gets older and as the queer scene develops, basically. And I think when you get to the 80s and 90s, and certainly Soho exploded, it's when I first arrived in London, you know, you suddenly have bars with windows out to the street. It was actually open and you could see people inside and they were gay and nobody minded. But for Mr. Lucas, who was always a man of the shadows, shining the spotlights either upon the gay scene, but also upon sex he didn't like. I mean, for example, shows like Hair, the musical in the 60s, which had kind of stage nudity, he loathed that. He found it kind of unerotic. It ruined the mystique behind sex for him.
So it was partly the excitement of it being illegal. So what did that mean for the 1960s when there was growing pressure to change the law?
Yeah, I mean, hugely. It's really weird. I mean, you go from the kind of 40s and 50s where post-war, again, gay men, women, everyone served during the war. So there was kind of like, you know, not a relaxation of the laws. I mean, certainly, you know, you come to 1945 and the gay men who served openly are now banged up and back in prison. That happened hugely in Germany in particular. But certainly for Mr. Lucas, opportunity went down, but I think more because, again, the commercialization. I think there were more people. And again, the close-knit nature of the gay scene. He would go to the Golden Lion every night, the pub, but he knew he'd bump into people. And because with the influx of strangers, with the influx of more people, I think it kind of ruined it for him, basically.
So was he part of any formal campaign to decriminalise homosexuality?
No, it was never on the barricades, shall we say. Never a placard waver. But he did go along to several of the meetings of the Campaign for Homosexual Equality. It was one of the groups back in the 50s and 60s that did quite a bit to push for the legalisation of gay sex. And he did write to his MP and he did, you know, turn up occasionally, I should qualify. But yeah, he was very much, you know, this is the right thing to happen. This should happen. It's unbelievable that in this day and age it shouldn't. And yet he was an economic conservative, but he definitely a social liberal, basically.
And how did life change for him after 1967?
Well, I mean, he writes quite poignantly in his diary of 1969 on December the 31st, on New Year's Eve, of how he'd expected the legalization of gay sex to bring more opportunity. And yet for him, and there's a very poignant passage about how the orchard he expected to be open and easy picking of fresh apples was bare and bitter and gone. So despite the fact that all his hopes were that life would become simpler and easier, it actually became slightly more depressing for him somehow. But I think that's more age kicking in, more than anything else. And also, you'll see kind of socially as well that the guardsmen were moving out of London at that point. There weren't so many kind of soldiers for hire, should we say, as this, you know, there were in the 60s. In the 70s, that stops, and you get these professional rent boys who are, and again, forgive me, but quite damaged characters, you know. So the nature of the scene is becoming nastier to a certain extent.
By the time he died, things had changed utterly for gay men. What did he think about that?
Well, I met him, as I said, in 1994. And a year beforehand, I was one of three people who took the British government to the European Court of Human Rights over the gay age consent in the UK. And through our court case, it went down from 21, that was at that point still, from 1967, down to 18. And when I first met him, I think why he was quite keen to meet me, because he'd heard about the campaign or whatever. But he was fully on board with that, fully on board of the notion of equality, and again, the complete lack of understanding of why equality hadn't happened earlier. So he was never a campaigner, but he was just a human being thinking, why don't we have equality? This is just bonkers.
And he really wanted to share this with you, obviously, because he answered your ad, and then he was happy to share all this extraordinarily revealing intimate stuff.
When I first met him, as I said, for the documentary, he pulled out of the documentary in the end and said, no, I think actually I'd prefer my words to be voiced by an actor. But we started talking about the diaries and what to do with them. And he was always very keen for me to publish them in some form. So I used to go around and see him about 3-4 times a year. And he'd get the will out. He'd have the will laminated, but of course, because that's very much Mr. Lucas. So he'd check my address and check the, you know, when we got to mobile phones, check the mobile phone number, stuff like that. But always in the will was, you know, for Hugo Greenhalgh to publish in some form, rights therein, blah, 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 blah. So it was always his idea that after he died, that I'd be able to do something with the diary. So if nothing else, I think I've done him proud, quite frankly.
It sounds as though you have. And how long did it take you to put together the book? Because there's so much material here.
I first started off with a Facebook page, thanks to a couple of friends, colleagues of mine, when I was at the Financial Times, who said, okay, pick a year and, you know, put up a couple of diary entries each weekend. I was doing that. I'm still doing it now, actually, about 5-6 years ago. And then that, it caused a lot of interest. I got an agent, put together a pitch. So, but overall, probably about 2 or 3 years later, the book, which is out on May the 5th, finally came together. Sorry, I had to get a plug in somehow. But no, it's a labor of love, basically. And I hope you read it.
What do you think he'd say about it?
I wonder, actually, because I do question a lot about which Mr. Lucas we're reading. Because what is a diary, basically, other than the kind of the wail of the misunderstood, nobody understands who I really am, etc., etc. So are we reading Mr. Lucas? Are we reading a persona? The one he feels he should be, the witty, the intelligent, the charming Mr. Lucas? Huh. So I doubt he'd like that bit, basically, because I think he's built a persona for the diaries, which is pretty solid and watertight. And I think he'd find that I'm slightly undermining that in the book by questioning which Mr. Lucas we're really getting.
Mr. Lucas's ambivalent attitude towards his sexuality was not surprising. In the 1950s and 1960s, homophobia was routine. MPs thought it was hugely undesirable, even repellent. They complained that gay men were a constant menace to youth. Blackmail was common. Even MPs who wanted a change in the law argued for it on the basis that fewer gay men would end up in jail, where they might tempt others to have more sex. In 1954, Sir Robert Boothby argued for the treatment of homosexuality rather than imprisonment because,
Our prisons today, in their present overcrowded condition, are factories for the manufacture of homosexuality. Anybody who knows anything about them will confirm this. It is an absolute madness to send these people to our ordinary overcrowded prisons and put them quite frequently in a cell with others and sometimes even in a dormitory together. Everybody who knows what happens in our prisons will realize the effect on ordinary criminals and that the thing spreads.
Who could have guessed that Sir Robert himself was bisexual? But saying so in Parliament was unthinkable. He died in 1986 and did once go so far as to say that subconscious bisexuality is a component part of all of us, and the majority of males pass through a homosexual period. Boothby, like Mr. Lucas, had links to the Cray twins through an affair with a cat burglar in the early 1960s and, not reportedly, because the papers wouldn't run stories about it, gay orgies in an East London flat. Even by 1967, as far as most people were concerned, homosexuality was still a thing to be deplored and constrained as much as possible. The campaigner Peter Tatchell arrived in London from Australia 4 years later, in 1971.
Despite the partial limited decriminalisation in 1967, in England and Wales only, most aspects of gay male life remained criminalised, and they were not finally decriminalised in full until 2003. So all through the 1970s, 80s and 90s, thousands of gay and bisexual men, and even a few lesbians, were convicted of consenting same-sex behaviour. There were police raids on gay bars, clubs and saunas. Even private birthday parties were raided by the police. On top of that, we saw same-sex couples being arrested for kissing or even holding hands. Police were at war with our community. And on top of that, none of the historic anti-LGBT plus laws, some of them dating back centuries, had been repealed. So this was still an era where it was illegal for same-sex couples to foster or adopt children. There was no legal recognition of same-sex partnerships. We did not exist in law. We had no rights as next of kin. Discrimination in housing, employment, and the provision of goods and services was lawful. So a plumber or a carpenter who came to fix your house could refuse to do it if he believed that you were LGBT. An employer could sack you or refuse to hire you. A landlord could evict you from premises just because of your sexual orientation or gender identity. And on top of that, there was widespread vilification and scapegoating of LGBT plus people in the popular press. In that era, there was hardly ever any media coverage of anything positive about LGBT plus people. The only coverage was negative when LGBTs were exposed as child molesters, spies, or serial killers. That was about it. You know, it felt like we were the enemy within. And indeed, that's how many politicians regarded us.
And indeed, in the early 1980s, you tried to get involved in politics, and that proved impossible, didn't it? Because you were gay.
In 1983, I fought the notorious Bermondsey by-election as the gay rights supporting left-wing Labour candidate. That election was the dirtiest, most violent, and definitely most homophobic election in Britain in the 20th century. I had hundreds of threats, more than 100 violent assaults in the street as I was coming out of my flat. I had attacks upon my home, including bricks and bottles through the window, even a bullet through my front door. It was like living through a low-level civil war, unparalleled in the UK, anywhere outside of the north of Ireland, where the war was ongoing. The attacks on me were threefold. First of all, many people objected to the fact that I was born in Australia, so there was a strong streak of xenophobia. There were also objections that I was a left-wing candidate, that I was standing up for social justice, for a fairer society. People demonized me as an extremist. And then, of course, because of my support for LGBT plus rights, that added to another layer of vilification and hatred. I was the first mainstream political candidate to explicitly advocate LGBT plus rights. It had never been done before because politicians were too afraid. Even those who privately supported our community were afraid to say so publicly because they feared the tabloid backlash and they feared that voters would turn against them. Prior to me in Bermondsey in 1983, the only other politician who had come out was the Labour politician Maureen Colquhoun in Northampton North. She was actually outed by the Daily Mail, but eventually, sometime later, did come out. So I was really, you know, one of the first trailblazing. It wasn't until after the Bermondsey by-election, partly in response to the public revulsion of the way I'd been treated, particularly the violence against me, that Chris Smith felt able to come out. And then there were others like Stephen Twigg a bit later in the 80s, Angela Igor, and so on. But, you know, what I was doing back in the 80s was very exceptional. And it was because of the toxic homophobic atmosphere of that time. It just wasn't possible for LGBT plus candidates or MPs to be out about their sexuality.
How long did the police persecution of gay men go on? Because they used to deliberately hang out in public toilets, posing as gay men themselves in order to try to entrap gay men. How long did that go on for?
It only began to change when the LGBT plus Direct Action Group was founded in 1990. That organization, which I was very honored to be a part of, was a reaction to two things. First of all, a horrific tirade of homophobic murders and violence, particularly the death of Michael Booth, the actor, who was kicked to death by queer bashers in West London. But also the way in which the police were pretty much indifferent to queer bashing violence, but putting huge resources into arresting gay and bisexual men for consenting victimless behavior. So outrage was established under the twin allied themes of protection, not persecution, and policing without prejudice. We began a very high-profile campaign of direct action against the police, exposing undercover police agents provocateurs who were conducting entrapment operations in parks and public toilets, interrupting the press conferences of the Metropolitan Police, invading and occupying police stations that were targeting our community. And we told the stories of LGBT plus people who'd been victimized. So, for example, lesbianism was not against the law, but the police used the Public Order Act, the clause prohibiting behavior likely to cause harassment, alarm, and distress, to arrest and convict lesbians. A very famous case was at Victoria Station in the early 1990s. A lesbian couple gave each other a goodnight hug and kiss at the ticket barriers, and they were arrested on the grounds their behavior had caused public harassment, alarm, or distress. They were taken to court, they were convicted, they were fined, they got a criminal record. Now, when we told those kinds of stories, most people thought this was an obsessive, overzealous policing. And public opinion began to turn against the police. So eventually the police called us into New Scotland Yard, and outrage went there with a set of demands, 12 demands for a non-homophobic, non-biphobic, non-transphobic policing policy. The police were completely thrown because they just saw us as a protest group. But here we had practical, achievable goals and ideas, some of them borrowed from more progressive police services in cities like Amsterdam, Copenhagen, and Stockholm. So very reluctantly and gradually over the next year, bit by bit, they agreed to three quarters of our demands for a non-homophobic policing policy. For example, appointing an LGBT plus community liaison officer, opting to alert the gay press and LGBT plus organizations about potential raids in parks and public toilets, using the alternative of a warning or a caution rather than immediate arrest and prosecution. That had a really big impact, so much so that as this spread across the UK, the number of gay and bisexual men convicted for consenting behaviour fell by two-thirds. Two-thirds fall, the biggest, fastest fall ever recorded. And that literally saved thousands of gay and bisexual men from arrest, conviction, fines, possibly even imprisonment. And it also saved many from losing their jobs, the breakup of their marriages, and violent assaults and attacks upon their homes. So I'm really, really proud of what Outrage did. That was a really good example. And from that moment onwards, you know, the police persecution of LGBT plus people fell off very sharply. It didn't entirely stop. In 1998, there was the notorious show trial of the Bolton Seven. These were seven gay men in Bolton, in Northwest England, who had been arrested and convicted on the grounds that they had sex in circumstances where more than two people were present in the house at the time, and that some of these sex acts had been videoed. These were still criminal offences, and these men, most of them, got convicted. Shockingly, in 1998, they were convicted for behaviour that was not even a crime between heterosexual men and women. But that was sort of the last swan song of police victimisation.
What do you think ultimately altered public opinion and led to the age of consent being reduced to 18 and then to 16?
There's no doubt in my mind that gay law reform, including the equalisation of the age of consent at 16, came about through a combination of protest and insider lobbying of government. And also, very important, the testimonies of young gay and bisexual men who were under the then age of consent for them of 21. They told their personal stories, and those personal stories resonated with many people in the wider public. They may not have approved of homosexuality, but they thought hearing those young voices, hearing about the potential 2 years imprisonment they could have got, that prompted a change in public opinion. And off the back of that change of public opinion, members of parliament were emboldened to initiate change. And of course, all the time in the background to this was the ongoing protests by the LGBT plus group Outrage, highlighting these inequalities, getting them covered in the press, which raised public awareness. Off the back of that, there were radio phone-in programs, TV discussion, chat shows. All these different things raised public awareness about the huge scale of anti-LGBT plus discrimination that still existed in Britain, even in the 1990s. And as a result, public opinion changed. And when public opinion changed, more MPs felt brave enough to vote for equality. The 1990s coincided with a huge coming out of LGBT plus people. And we knew from research, which is why we promoted coming out, that someone, a straight person who knows a gay person, will be much more likely to support equality. So that mass coming out was really, really important. It was key to helping change hearts and minds.
When I first spoke to Peter, I used the word decriminalisation. He pulled me up on that, and rightly so. Just because gay sex in private, under certain circumstances, was no longer illegal, didn't make it possible to be gay without discrimination. It wasn't until 20, 30, 40, even 50 or more years later that men felt able to be open about it. If this edition has piqued your interest, you can pre-order The Diaries of Mr. Lucas, Notes from a Lost Gay Life, using the link in the show notes. You'll be helping to support the podcast too. What would Mr. Lucas's life be like now? He wouldn't have to keep his sexuality a secret at the Department for International Trade. A few years ago, it was ranked as one of the top 10 most inclusive government departments. They've had a float at Pride. He'd probably be hooking up with military types on Grindr. But for gay men, the story of the 20th century was one of concealment, harassment, and living in fear of the law. I'm Roz Taylor, and that was Jam Tomorrow. It's 40 years since the miners' strike began. Have you listened to our episode on coal? Find out what the public really thought of miners and why they lost their battle with Margaret Thatcher. Just search for Jam Tomorrow on your podcast app. See you next time.
Jam Tomorrow was written and presented by Roz Taylor and was produced by me, Jade Bailey. Voiceover work was by Seth Tavel. Music was by Dubstar and artwork is by Jim Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. Jam Tomorrow is a Podmasters production.